No, maybe not that ambitious, but we will start in Proverbs 21. And again, it's good to see everybody, and hope that you're doing well. And again, excited to be back with you. Okay, it's 7 o'clock. Maybe if you want to bow with me in prayer. Our Almighty Heavenly Father, we're so thankful for you for giving us this opportunity to come and partake of this Bible study together and open your Word and hopefully find something to apply to our lives. We're so thankful for the wisdom that we've gotten to look at and examine and already apply to our lives over the last handful of weeks in this quarter. Thankful that we've gotten to study Proverbs and that portion of your Word, and that there's so much there that we can use that, although written long ago, is still incredibly relevant to our lives. Thankful for the brothers and sisters that we have here to study that Word with as well, and for their encouragement, for just the encouragement it is to see them and to be built up by them, and hopeful that together we can strive to be more like you and that we can come away with more wisdom founded in your Word. As we think about those who aren't here with us tonight, we just want to acknowledge them and know that we're happy if they're able to be watching online, or happy that if there's any way that we can continue to interact with them and mutually benefit with them and grow closer to you with them. But also hope that if it be your will, that they have another opportunity to attend here with us and that we can gather with them physically and continue to build each other up. We just pray again in thanks for you and in thanks for opportunities like these. And it's in your Son's name that we pray. Amen. Okay, with that said, Proverbs 21. Last handful of chapters of Proverbs that we've been through, particularly the ones that we've been through with me standing here, Proverbs 18 and 19, very, very much so about motivation in the world, right? And things that can motivate people, about how they can sometimes change our personal interactions with people, and about how we can model those personal interactions and those relationships that we have to be more like what God wants. And the last handful of chapters contain no small amount of warnings about how sometimes those relationships don't go as God intends for various reasons and various things that can corrupt us. So that's where we've been. I would say that tonight in Proverbs 21, and if we get through the next few chapters, a lot of them deal with, again, continuing to apply God's wisdom to different aspects of our life. You'll notice that tonight a lot of the chapters end up dealing with your finances. We got into that maybe just a teensy bit last week in dealing with, talking about how people sometimes acquire things and don't necessarily show you the bidding process that they went through with that, or sometimes can be deceptive in that bargaining process when they buy things. So talked about that just a little bit last week, but this week we'll continue to talk about wealth and power and how they can corrupt people. Okay, with that said, starting, and we did chapter 20 last week, so starting in Proverbs 21, maybe if someone would volunteer to read the first 15 verses of Proverbs 21. Yeah, Casey?
The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he will. Every way of a man is right in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the heart. To do righteousness and justice is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice. Haughty eyes and a proud heart, the lamp of the wicked, are sin. The plans of the diligent lead surely to abundance, but everyone who is hasty comes only to poverty. The getting of treasures by a lying tongue is a fleeting vapor and a snare of death. The violence of the wicked will sweep them away because they refuse to do what is just. The way of the guilty is crooked, but the conduct of the pure is upright. It is better to live in a corner of the housetop than in a house shared with a quarrelsome wife. The soul of the wicked desires evil. His neighbor finds no mercy in his eyes. When a scoffer is punished, the simple become wise. When a wise man is instructed, he gains knowledge. The righteous one observes the house of the wicked. He throws the wicked down to ruin. Whoever closes his ear to the cry of the poor will himself call out and not be answered. A gift in secret averts anger, and a concealed bribe strong wrath. When justice is done, it is a joy to the righteous, but terror to evildoers.
Thank you, Casey. And stop there in particular. Maybe some early verses in this talk about your heart and the condition of that, and some things that can corrupt your heart. And maybe as we end the first 15 verses here, talk a lot about how that, again, manifests when you deal with people, and particularly how sometimes we teach people. Sometimes wickedness, we're converted by people. Some, you know, it mentions bribery here in the last couple of verses. But again, very, very focused on what's inside of you and how that frequently manifests when you deal with others. So let me open it up. Any thoughts on the first 15 verses here? Yeah.
One of the things, you know, whenever we're reading in Proverbs, that a lot of these things jump out at me, and this isn't the only place that you see it, but you take into account that this was written in the Old Testament time. In the Old Testament time, when we think about the old laws in the Old Testament, we think about sacrifice and sacrifice. You know, I did wrong, sacrifice, atonement. And then in verse 4 it says, to do righteousness and justice is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice, right? And so here's a people that are literally being taught, you know, hey, you have to do all of these atonements and all of these sacrifices and all of these things. And, you know, even in the midst of all that, God is saying, yeah, but you know what's even greater than doing that stuff? Live the right way. Yeah. Do the things that you're supposed to do so that you're not, you know, having to sacrifice the fatted calf. You're not having to do these things. And so I just, you know, that's one of those verses sometimes maybe we just kind of gloss over, but in the context of, you know, Old Testament Jews, you know, or the nation of Israel reading that and seeing that, I think that that might hit them a little bit harder because, you know, that's part of their daily lives. Like, you know, I don't know that we've ever had to take an animal to a slaughter unless we work in, you know, farming or something, but that's, yeah, that was basically their daily repetition, their weekly repetition, you know, something that was just in, you know, part of who they were.
Absolutely. And not a verse that I'd picked out, but again, so many of these verses you think end up directly being pulled through to the New Testament and concepts that we see there. Two quick thoughts I had on that about times that we see that very concept present itself in the New Testament. One, you know, Jesus talks about, you know, on the Sabbath, you would traditionally sacrifice your time, right, and your freedom to be able to go do things. But if there was a chance to, you know, save an animal on the Sabbath, surely you would do that, right? Or if there was certainly a time to save your brother, you would take the time to do that even on the Sabbath, even though it meant that you might not necessarily be, you know, fulfilling that sacrifice and saying, you know, I'm going to sacrifice and lock myself down today and not have the same freedom of action that I would on other days. You would put that aside to go do the right thing in that situation. The righteousness and being able to benefit someone would be more important than that. And then a second, the Pharisees were talking about, you know, oh, I can't support my aging family members because I keep sacrificing and giving to the church. And I remember, and I want to say that's in Matthew 20, but what they were told there was, you should have done the weightier matters of the law without leaving the lesser undone. and in when we think about what those weightier matters are, I think it's what's mentioned here, righteousness and justice. Those are kind of the weightier aspects of following God. Other thoughts? Yeah?
Just more of an opinion, but I get... It seems like there's some consistency, and it talks about, you know, the actions that one would describes how we should act and try to be and all that kind of thing. But where does verses 9 and 19 shake out of there? It just seems kind of odd.
Yeah, and specifically those verses, at least 9, and I believe 19 as well, dealing with... Yeah. I was going to briefly mention, Mr. Kierko, that those are verses where, you know, frequently if you mention those in the heat of the argument, that might only worsen the situation. If you say, you know, I'm going to go up to the corner of the housetop, that would be better than this. Don't recommend. I do agree that those kind of stick out as in, you know, kind of nuggets that are implanted here. I would say a lot of the last few chapters, though, they follow general themes about interpersonal relationships, about what's in your heart. It doesn't attempt to come out and say all of this is, like this chapter, it deals with what could lead to poverty. That's a consistent theme over the next few chapters. But the whole chapter of Proverbs 21 does not necessarily deal with that theme exclusively. So I don't know, maybe the Spirit of the Lord thought that was good wisdom for someone who was reading this chapter and said, you know what, someone's going to use that one. Ms. Mary Beth.
Then I was also questioning, like, they just kind of popped out, you know, the two wife ones. But then I went back and reread, And all through, well, not, I mean, all through even the Proverbs before this, but all through Proverbs 21, there are constant admonishments towards being haughty, being a scoffer, being unwise, being hasty, thinking too much of yourself, and a lot of it is he will fall to ruin, or every way of a man is right in his eyes, but you know that's foolishness, or the king, or so men are being also admonished, and it's just and then two popped out for wives. I don't know. But it's not like men are not being also admonished about, you know, watching out for all of these negative habits and attributes.
Which, and again, you know, hard to get in the mind of the author sometimes and explain why things were arranged a certain way. But I would say in this case, you're right to point out that there's a lot of advisement on avoiding a lot of kind of sin, right? Avoiding, just generally avoiding things that would lead you down to wickedness or would ensnare you and tempt you to have further vice. And surely one of those things is that if you degrade your relationship and the person that you live with, that is not going to lead you anywhere good. Certainly that's going to be a thing that would lead you to more wickedness, more contempt for people, and not a good thing. So, don't know, but I would say that, yeah, it's a chapter with a lot of wisdom on how we can avoid conflict and avoid sin. One extra thing I would say is if you're someone who's reading this and you're having trouble applying it and you say, you know, I live in an apartment, we don't have a corner of a housetop, where do I hide? See me after class. we'll talk through that. Any other thoughts? Yeah.
I think there's a point here, and kind of went along with what Dwayne was talking about, but maybe he was talking about the sacrifice thing and them almost being pursuing the letter of the law, but here in verse 2, a person may think their ways are right, but the Lord weighs the heart. It's not about doing things, it's about the condition of our hearts. And I think that can also help in a sense with verse 9, where it talks about the quarrelsome part there. First of all, if I have a right kind of heart, I will do things to derail that rather than get involved in being quarrelsome. So my heart, our hearts may play a big role in this. And we don't just do things to do them because those things don't get us to heaven. It's at the condition of our heart that does.
Yeah, and that was one of the questions that I had for myself reading through this is, you know, it's a kind of a contrast between, you know, whether you're right in your own eyes and whether you're right in your own heart. And those are two very different things. Your eyes may be looking around at what you see, kind of the windshield economics of there. Of, you know, I look at other people in my life, I look at other Christians even, and I say, you know, what are they doing? And then kind of by comparison, where do I stack up on that fulfilling the law and on managing my life well and things like that? And that is not necessarily the judge that you should be guiding on as much as what's in your heart, and are you attempting to do what God's word is, not necessarily what your eyes are out seeing in the world. Had another question on the first 15 here. In verse 5, I thought was also interesting. The plans of the diligent lead surely to abundance, but everyone who is hasty comes only to poverty. That is strong language in verse 5, leads, at least in my version, the plans of the diligent lead surely to abundance. Does that mean that all Christians who are diligent are going to find wealth on earth? No. What could it be talking about there, though, that if you're diligent, it'll lead to abundance?
Living, God put it in terms of everlasting life.
Yeah, and so many times in the New Testament, we hear about our faith and our inheritance being compared to gold. I would say that it's the case in Proverbs, and it's the case just in the Bible in general, that sometimes I won't call it mixing their metaphors, but we can jump back and forth between this idea of managing your money on earth and on understanding that your reward isn't all measured in money. The second part of this verse even says, everyone who is hasty comes only to poverty. And I would agree that that, maybe not even in just only in relation to salvation, when it says the path of the diligent leads to abundance, generally what you're diligent in, you will be, you know, eventually abound in if you are correct in your diligence. And generally speaking, if you're hasty in that thing, and that's whatever it is, right? If you're hasty in your salvation, if you're hasty in your decisions about who to marry, if you're hasty in plenty of the decisions that you can have about your life, right? That will eventually lead to poverty if you were rushing those things. And again, the first time I read that, I wanted to immediately apply it to you know, financial means, and I think that's, you know, kind of what we think about when we read the word poverty, not necessarily exclusive to what it's describing. Yeah.
I think, you know, that's why even in modern times, why we have high pressure sales, right? Because they know if you can make it seem like, well, if you don't buy this now, I've got three other people waiting, right? They're wanting you to make a decision that you don't think about and think through. And they're wanting you to overspend, but they're wanting you to, you know, have an emotional response to this thing. And then you end up afterwards, you know, the word we use in modern times is buyer's remorse, right? Like, man, I can't believe, you know, I should have thought about it. I should have slept on it. I should have done that, right? But there's very aggressive sales tactics, you know, for exactly this sort of thing. And so, you know, again, it's just kind of interesting that, you know, these are the sorts of things as my kids are getting older that we talk about, like, you know, there's tons of houses out there. There's tons of cars out there. There's tons of, you know, don't ever make a hasty decision, right? Just take your time, think through it, you know, make sure that you've considered all of the options and avenues, right? And Jesus, you know, he taught about that. Who's going to start building a tower, right, without first considering the cost? And that's, you know, a lot of times what I come back to with my kids is, you know, don't start building that tower until we've thought through it, right? What does that mean? How does that look? So. And you know, again, an interesting dichotomy as far as you know, the way the world wants us to be, and the way, you know, Christ, and even, you know, in Proverbs that we see that we're taught to be. It's a very different sort of thing.
If I could connect briefly your point about high pressure sales to a little bit of worldly wisdom, I had a little bit of education in marketing in college, and one of the things that that literally people in sales and people in marketing are taught is information asymmetry, right? When the salesperson is doing this, or when whoever's on the counterparty to the decision that you're making, when they have more information than you do, and frequently one of the ways, you know, obviously that puts them in an advantageous situation to fleece you, right, or to squeeze more out of you than they otherwise could. And one of the ways that happens is that you don't take a lot of time to consider your actions. And I think the Bible is very, you know, diligent, not only in this, but in plenty of other cases, to tell you, hey, slow down and think about what you're doing, and also to pray for wisdom. And that's a thing that we're told to do countless times in the Bible, and I think those two things, right, of being diligent to pray for wisdom, diligent to take time to apply that wisdom, connects very directly to this advice here, that if you make hasty decisions, that will lead to poverty in your life. Okay, maybe moving on, if someone would read from verse 16 down to the rest of the chapter.
I'm not above it. Yeah, Phil?
One who wanders from the way of good sense will rest in the assembly of the dead. Whoever loves pleasure will be a poor man. He who loves wine and oil will not be rich. The wicked is a ransom for the righteous, and the traitor for the upright. It is better to live in a desert land than with a quarrelsome and fretful woman. Precious treasure and oil are in a wise man's dwelling, but a foolish man devours it. Whoever pursues righteousness and kindness will find life, righteousness, and honor. A wise man scales the city of the mighty and brings down the stronghold in which they trust. Whoever keeps his mouth and his tongue keeps himself out of trouble. Scoffer is the name of the arrogant, haughty man, who acts with arrogant pride. The desire of the sluggard kills him, for his hands refuse to labor. All day long he craves and craves, but the righteous gives and does not hold back. The sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination. How much more when he brings it with evil intent? A false witness will perish, but the word of a man who hears will endure. A wicked man puts on a bold face, but the upright gives thought to his ways. No wisdom, no understanding, no counsel can avail against the Lord. A horse is made ready for the day of battle, that the victory belongs to the Lord.
Thank you, Phil. Okay, thoughts on the rest of this chapter here? And again, changes tones maybe just a little bit from the first 15, but thoughts on the chapter? One that I had here in verse 17, whoever loves pleasure will be a poor man. He who loves wine and oil will not be rich. An interesting thought, right, that I think in the New Testament we're kind of counseled against storing up treasures on earth, right, and storing up our wealth for, you know, being able to spend that in some future time. Here in verse 17 of Proverbs 21, it also counsels us against using that on pleasure right now, or wealth, right? So kind of a double whammy, that one, that Christians aren't to store up their wealth for future days, and two, that we're not to use it on pleasure right now. How are Christians supposed to use that? And, yeah, please.
One thing that stuck out to me was the stronghold part, to have strength of confidence thereof. It says cast down that stronghold. So basically the stronghold that's like holding you back is not good. That's what your stronghold should be, God, you know, and God only, not anything like of this world, you know. It
casts
it down, so that
kind of
stood out to me.
And specifically it says a wise man does that, right? That they're able to bring down even that strong city. There are plenty of wise people on earth. and a few of those wise people might be interested in bringing down your strong city. And I think, yeah, to that point, that's a beautiful connection of, you know, you can spend your time building up a city. That won't necessarily make you safe. Won't necessarily make that a permanent thing that you have. Yeah, Dwayne?
Just a modern thing that I just always kind of shake my head in amazement. You know, Ed came forward 2 weeks ago and said, hey, there's a need. We need Bibles, you know. And in one Sunday, we collected $1,400, right? If we were all foolish and we were all just squandered our money and we didn't have those stores, you know, laid back for that sort of effort, then, you know, when the storms come, we wouldn't be prepared. And I think there's a difference between, you know, having this enormous amount of wealth, right, and saying, hey, I'm able to help the needy, right? If you know, we sing a song about a single cup of water is, you know, all that I ask for and that's all that you have, that's all that I need, right? But there's something humbling about saying, hey, here are people that are halfway around the globe that speak an entirely different language than us, that maybe haven't even ever been exposed to the gospel. And being able to say that a small portion of the financial blessings that we have here in America, that we're able to give of that abundance and, you know, provide Bibles and you know, functionally go to spread the gospel. And we see that in the New Testament, right? We see that every time we gather together on Sunday, we take up a collection, and it's not because, you know, we want to make pretty stained glass or we want to have, you know, gold emblazoned things all over. It's when we have a need, we can fill that need, right? And so I think there's a line there between, you know, opulence and exuberance and then just saving up this enormous amount of wealth. And I know enormous isn't really a word, that's a plain word. But, you know, this very large amount of wealth and saying, hey, I'm wise and smart with my money and I can help when I need to be helped. And I, you know, or when help is needed, and I don't make a hasty decision when it comes to, you know, I want the biggest new house or I want the fastest new car or I need the newest IT item or whatever it might be, right? That we can make measured and thoughtful decisions and still be able to help brothers and sisters.
I think that is a very one timely point, right? We had a
very recent example that Dwayne brought out that of a time where there was a pressing need to be able to, one, have those resources to bring to bear at that time, and two, that that there were other options, right? There's a competition for how we spend our wealth on the earth that we accumulate, and frequently, if the wrong things win that competition, there is a real-world consequence. that you know, less good things can't happen if you don't spend your resources wisely. You alluded to the man who built the larger barn for himself and was criticized for that and said, you know, why are you building a larger barn? won't have time to spend that while you're on earth, and that that's not a permanent thing and that you can build your trust in. There are some examples in the New Testament of people who were advised to sell what they have. Example in Acts 1 or 2 of the church there being very generous with their wealth and selling their possessions and giving to others. But in that particular instance, the man wasn't criticized for having a barn in the first place. And he wasn't criticized for having a store of wealth that was able to provide for his family if something bad happened, or to, you know, if there was a need, to give to other people. He was criticized for building onto that barn, right, and continuing to accumulate beyond what he needed. And I think at a certain point, we're kind of taught that you storing up more wealth has diminishing returns, right? And that at a certain point, you need to go find good ways to deploy that money and be a good blessing to other people. But again, in many other cases, it's a good thing to have some prudence there and to say, I've got some resources ready for when there's a need. Other thoughts? Okay, one more that I had on this chapter, and it's in verse 30. I'm not going to read verse 30 out loud, but you read verse 30 and you tell me, if you make yourself an enemy of the Lord, what listed in verse 30 could help you? Nothing. nothing at all will help you if you make yourself an enemy of the Lord. And it even says no wisdom. I thought that was wisdom, understanding, counsel, three versions of similar concepts there. And I was thinking of why, you know, how come that couldn't avail against the Lord? Where does that wisdom come from? Yeah, it comes from the Lord, and that's a thing that we literally are blessed with from God. All of the resources that you could possibly bring to bear on earth, and any knowledge that you're going to have in your head, kind of would be a circular argument to say that that's going to prevail against the one who put all of that there in the first place. But that's what some people think, right? They think that that they're going to get to the judgment day once and be able to reason their way out of it and, you know, explain why they made themselves an enemy. And full-hearted to believe that.
You're talking about, I think about John 15, verse 5, Jesus talking to his disciples. And that whole topic there was the vine and the branches. But in talking to his disciples, he says, I'm going to just quote the one little phrase. Jesus says to them, apart from me, you can do nothing. And I think that goes well here in telling that. And I have to realize it's not about John. It's about me being one with God, and that's where my going forward is going to come from. I can't do it on my own.
And then the next verse of this in verse 31 brings that out to it and says, the horse is made ready for the day of the battle, but the victory belongs to the Lord, right? Like, anything that you were going to accomplish on earth is, you know, eventually tied back to the source of all of that power and all of that, you know, glory. And the example of a horse would have been maybe a little bit more pertinent in the time that this was written than in our time. But you think a horse was a great thing to have going into a battle. And, you know, allowed you to be more mobile on the battlefield, allowed you to be able to transverse long distances a little bit quicker, maybe even give you some, you know, one-on-one height advantage against whoever you're facing. But comparing God's might to a horse, there's no contest, right, of which of those things is more responsible for a victory. Okay, any other thoughts on Proverbs 21? Okay, if not, I'm going to move into Proverbs 22 here, and I'll read here, and I'm going to read the first 16 verses of Proverbs 22. A good name is to be chosen rather than great riches, and favor is better than silver or gold. The rich and the poor meet together. The Lord is the maker of them all. The prudent sees danger and hides himself, but the simple go on and suffer for it. The reward for humility and fear of the Lord is riches and honor and life. Thorns and snares are in the way of the crooked. Whoever guards his soul will keep far from them. Train up a child in the way that he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it. The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is the slave to the lender. Whoever sows injustice will reap calamity, and the rod of his fury will fail. Whoever has a bountiful eye will be blessed, for he shares his bread with the poor. Drive out a scoffer, and strife will go out, and quarreling and abuse will cease. He who loves purity of heart and whose speech is gracious will have the king as his friend. The eyes of the Lord keep watch over knowledge, but he overthrows the words of a traitor. The sluggard says, "There is a lion outside. I shall be killed in the streets." The mouth of forbidden women is a deep pit. He with whom the Lord is angry will fall into it. Folly is bound up with the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline drives it far from him. Whoever oppresses the poor to increase his own wealth or gives to the rich will only come to poverty. Okay, a lot of big concepts there in the first 16 verses of chapter 22. Any thoughts?
Tell me, verse 21, or verse 1, a good name, it shows you rather than great riches. He always said a good name is better than any gold you can get.
Mm-hmm. And plenty of people get to the end of their life and have amassed great riches and then are forced to try to buy back a good name and, you know, try to say, how can I, how can I donate this money or how can I give this away where people will remember me a little bit more fondly and not remember those years where I spent my life building this up. Oh, no. Yeah, I think it's ironic how many times we can see in the world God's wisdom just coming true time and time again, right? And that's one of those things that kind of proves itself when you see the actions that people take in the world to go buy back their good name or try to. Verse 7 stuck out to me, and in part because this is probably the most, I work in finance, and this is probably the most quoted verse in all of modern finance. If you've ever heard if Dave Ramsey was here tonight, he would have made it 50 comments by now. And this is like Dave Ramsey's favorite verse of all time, right? That the borrower is slave to the lender in verse 7. One, what does that mean and how do we apply that? Edwin?
If you owe somebody something, then you're subject to them, right? And a very, like, boiling down that concept as simple as it can. Right, and I think when we kind of work that out with our salvation, you know, we have a debt that's so great, there's nothing to do about it, right? And when you sit there and you think about that, that's what makes Jesus so amazing, right? Is the fact that we, through our actions, through our choices, through our sins, have dug ourselves such a great pit of debt that we can never, on our own, reconcile that debt. Yeah, make the ledger green again, balance both sides of the ledger. And so, in a very real sense, it's again that wisdom. I think there's a foreshadowing there to the New Testament. But I also think that it helps us to consider, again, before we go and do something or extend ourselves beyond our means, what is that, what else is that going to cost us? Besides saying, like when you get a mortgage, you get the truth in lending. Right, like, hey, you're buying a $250,000 house with all the interest you're going to pay over there 40 years or 30 years. It's really going to be $410,000, right? And you see that sticker shock, and you're like, what? $250,000 house? And that it starts to drive home the point that the price that you think you're going to pay when you go indebted to somebody else is not nearly the price that you end up actually paying.
Yeah, and you compared our debt to the Lord, right? And you describe that as a debt. It's described that way in the Bible a handful of times. And also that the inheritance is frequently, again, described as gold. You are given a very valuable thing already from the Lord. There is a heavy implication that you should serve the Lord then with your actions, right? And that you should, again, we just got done talking about the power of the Lord and the fact that nothing can prevail over Him. When you, again, tie together that thought that, man, everything I'm ever going to have comes from the Lord. The very breath in me comes from the Lord. The inheritance of eternal life comes from the Lord, right? This thing that, again, reading the Bible is compared to the most obvious symbol of wealth in all of humankind, right? Gold. And you say, then what do I do with my life and who do I serve? Should be a pretty obvious answer. And I think in verse 7 it brings out that sometimes earthly debt which by comparison is usually to someone far less powerful. I say that as somebody who works with banks a lot. Far less powerful than God is an understatement there. And it's a thing that can take up a lot more of your time, though, to think about, you know, am I able to repay this, and how do I go through that? Sometimes in the world of business, we call that kind of like the golden handcuffs, right? They get you in a career, and they get you with a mortgage and some kids to feed, and it is very easy to see that you're going to stick with your career, right, and that you're not going to go out and take a bunch of risk in your life, because they've kind of got you in a path where you're slave to a lender, right? You're slave to your responsibilities in a certain way on earth. And don't want to let that supersede a much bigger debt. Ed?
I do like that verse 2 where it says, the rich and the poor have this in common. The Lord is the maker of them all. You know, today we have a phrase that says it's self-made man. You know, and you hear that a lot. But, you know, that, and people took that as they move on up the ladder, you know, and how they made their own way, you know. But wasn't for, like you said, the blessings coming from God, they wouldn't have any of those things that they have. So we need to realize that, you know, we all have the same common denominator. We're made by God, you know. We're all blessed is what rains upon the just and the unjust. So we need to remind ourselves of that.
And even further, so much of this chapter is devoted to saying, hey, when you leave the Lord in certain ways, when you start being dishonest, when you start being sinful, when you start chasing after things that are forbidden to you, the Lord can separate you from that wealth. And the rich and the poor have that in common, in that God, whether you're rich or poor, you know, that God had a hand in making it that way and can have a hand in changing it, right? So your condition is not entirely of your own making at all. Other thoughts on the first 16 verses here of chapter 22?
And being a slave, you know, to the rich man. There's an inherent problem with borrowing and being in debt. And it's a warning. If I can't afford something, and say I borrow something, an expensive tool from Ed, for example. Now I've got this tool that I can't afford, and then I break it. Then I have to buy it, and it's not even for me. So debt is a problem, and borrowing is a problem, and even worse than when you get in the hands of unrighteous lenders.
Certainly, and that's a problem in this time that would have been very poignant to them, right? That they would have had usurious, sometimes interest rates that, you know, far beyond the close to 0% that you're seeing these days, would have been even more impactful for them to learn that lesson, because again, especially in this era, you get in debt and can really take over your life. Even today, we see the debt levels for people in America as high as it's ever been. See debt categories across the wave kind of rising up, and maybe not entirely, unrelated, that we've also seen higher anxiety rates and more people leaving the church and a lot of other things and problems that have crept up in our society that have kind of, again, not saying that they're one-to-one related. But you start getting in the world where people have a lot of other problems on earth. They've got to go repay that big debt. And suddenly you've got very pressing things in your life that are matters of the earth that you've got to go attend to, and can make it hard to focus on God. And also, yeah, can just put you in a bad spot where we talked about earlier, you having something to hold back for yourself, where if a problem happens or if there's a need that you can attend to, less to be able to do that with, right? When you owe Ed for that expensive tool. Yeah, Casey?
Reads to me like general guidelines. For instance, I mean, how many people in here borrow money for their house or have cars that they're paying on? I don't see a problem with some of that. It's the overboard part. It's like when I'm reading through this, I've read 6 and 15. We haven't touched on those, okay, but they're about raising kids. Those are hard, right? And just because you raise a kid up in the church doesn't mean that they're going to stay with the church forever. And that's not all on a pair either. Otherwise, there are a lot of people in here that are failures, right? And discipline with a rod. Does anyone take a rod to their kid? I think again, you got to use some common sense in there, and you can't read it as an adamant. This is exactly what God means, because you know, borrowing on a house, not necessarily bad.
No, certainly. I was going to get into the question here, and I don't know if I want to wade into that controversial line of where's the line of death that the Bible's trying to draw here. I would say it is. It's a general rule, right? That it is expressing to you that when you have a dead out there, right, that can, especially if you let it, start driving a lot of your actions on earth. And that those things can really start driving you down roads that you don't necessarily want to go and making things that shouldn't be your focus your focus. Again, in moderation, hopefully it doesn't become that severe. Okay, with that said, apparently I'm out of time. I think the lights have flickered a couple of times on me. I was hoping it was just the rain, but the clock says no. But okay, thank you all for your time tonight, and we'll be back one more time this quarter to talk about Proverbs.